Mr. Phelan, Josh Stafford addressed the anxious directors of the Phelan Group. 2 years earlier, Josh himself had been placed on the board by Mr. Phelan, but it was not a role he enjoyed. For the past 6 years, the Phelan Group had operated quite profitably without much assistance from its founder. For some reason, probably depression, Troy had lost interest in the day-to-day managing of his empire. He became content to simply monitor the markets and the earnings reports. The current CEO was Pat Solomon, a company man Troy had hired almost 20 years earlier. He was as nervous as the other seven when Stafford entered the room. There was ample cause for anxiety. Within the company's culture, there was a rich body of lore surrounding Troy's wives and his offspring, the vaguest hint that the ownership of the Phelan Group might somehow fall into the hands of those people would terrorize any board. Josh began by stating Mr. Phelan's desires regarding burial. "There will be no funeral," he said somberly. "Frankly, there's no way to pay your last respects." They absorbed this without comment. With the passing of a normal person, such non-arrangements would seem bizarre. But with Troy, it was difficult to be surprised. "Who will own the company?" Solomon asked. "I can't say now," Stafford said, well aware of how evasive and unsatisfactory his answer was. "Troy signed a will moments before he jumped, and he instructed me to keep it private for a period of time. I cannot, under any circumstances, divulge its contents, at least not for now."
"When?"
"Soon, but not now."
"So it's business as usual?"
"Exactly. This board remains intact. Everybody keeps his job. The company does tomorrow what it did last week." This sounded fine, but no one believed it. Ownership of the company was about to change hands. Troy had never believed in sharing stock in the Phelan Group. He paid his people well, but he did not buy into the trend of allowing them to own a piece of the company. About 3% of the stock was held by a few of his favorite employees. They spent an hour haggling over the wording of a press release, then adjourned for a month. Stafford met Tip Durbin in the lobby, and together they drove to the medical examiner's office in McLean. The autopsy was finished. The cause of death was obvious. There was no trace of alcohol or drugs of any kind. And there was no tumor, no sign of cancer. Troy was in good physical health at the time of his death, though slightly malnourished. Tip broke the silence as they were crossing the Potomac on the Roosevelt Bridge. "Did he tell you he had a brain tumor?"
"Yes, several times."
Stafford drove, though he was oblivious to roads, bridges, streets, cars. How many more surprises did Troy have?
"Why did he lie?"
"Who knows?
You're trying to analyze a man who just jumped from a building.
The brain tumor made everything urgent. Everybody, including me, thought he was dying. The wackiness made the panel of shrinks seem like a great idea. He set the trap. They rushed in, and now their own psychiatrists are swearing that Troy was perfectly sound. Plus, he wanted sympathy."
"But he was crazy, wasn't he? He did, after all, take a leap."
"Troy was weird in a lot of ways, but he knew exactly what he was doing."
"Why did he jump?"
"Depression. He was a very lonely old man." They were on Constitution Avenue, sitting in heavy traffic, both staring at the taillights in front of them and trying to think it through.
"It seems fraudulent," Durbin said. "He lures them in with the promise of money. He satisfies their psychiatrists, then at the last second he signs a will that completely guts them."
"It was fraudulent, but this is a will, not a contract. A will is a gift. Under Virginia law, a person is not required to leave a dime to his children."
"But they'll attack, won't they?"
"Probably. They have lots of lawyers.
There's too much money at stake. Why did he hate them so much? He thought they were leeches. They embarrassed him. They fought with him. They never earned an honest dime and went through many of his millions. Troy never planned to leave them anything. He figured that if they could squander millions, then they could waste billions as well. And he was right. How much of the family fighting was his fault? A lot. Troy was a hard man to love. He told me once that he'd been a bad father and a terrible husband. He couldn't keep his hands off women, especially ones who worked for him. He thought he owned them. I remember some claims for sexual harassment. We settled them quietly, and for big bucks. Troy didn't want the embarrassment. Any chance of more unknown heirs out there? I doubt it, but what do I know? I never dreamed he had another heir, and the idea of leaving her everything is something I cannot comprehend. Troy and I spent hours talking about his estate and how to divide it. How do we find her? I don't know. I haven't thought about her yet. The Stafford law firm was in a frenzy when Josh returned. By Washington standards, it was considered small, 60 lawyers. Josh was the founder and principal partner. Tip Durbin and four others were called partners, which meant Josh listened to them occasionally and shared some of the profits. For 30 years, it had been a rough-and-tumble litigation firm, but as Josh approached 60, he spent less time in the courtroom and more time behind his cluttered desk. He could have had 100 lawyers if he wanted ex-senators, lobbyists, and regulatory analysts, the usual D.C. lineup. But Josh loved trials and courtrooms, and he hired only young associates who had tried at least 10 jury cases. The average career of a litigator is 25 years. The first heart attack usually slows them down enough to delay a second. Josh had avoided burnout by tending to Mr. Phelan's maze of legal needs, securities, antitrust, employment, mergers, and dozens of personal matters. Three sets of associates waited in the reception room of his large office. Two secretaries shoved memos and phone messages in his direction as he removed his overcoat and settled behind his desk. "Which is most urgent?" he asked.
"This, I think," answered a secretary.
It was from Hart Geddes, a man Josh had talked to at least 3 times a week for the past month. He dialed the number and Hart was immediately on the line. They quickly went through the pleasantries and Hart got right to the point. "Listen, Josh, you can imagine how the family is breathing down my neck." "I'm sure. They want to see the damned will, Josh, or at least they want to know what's in it." The next few sentences would be crucial, and Josh had plotted them carefully. "Not so fast, Hark." A very slight pause, then, "Why, is something the matter?" "The suicide bothers me."
"What? What do you mean?"
"Look, Hark, how can a man be of sound mind seconds before he jumps to his death?"
Hark's edgy voice rose an octave, and the words carried even more anxiety.
"But you heard our psychiatrists. Hell, they're on tape."
"Are they sticking by their opinions in light of the suicide?"
"Damn right they are."
"Can you prove this?"
"I'm looking for help here, Hark."
"Josh, last night we examined our three shrinks again. We grilled them, and they're sticking like glue. Each signed an affidavit 8 pages long, swearing to the sound mental capacity of Mr. Phelan."
"Can I see the affidavits?"
"I'll courier them over right now."
"Please do."
Josh hung up and smiled to no one in particular. The associates were marched in, 3 sets of bright and fearless young lawyers. They sat around a mahogany table in one corner of the office. Josh began by summarizing the contents of Troy's handwritten will and the legal problems it was likely to create. To the first team, he assigned the weighty issue of testamentary capacity. Josh was concerned about time, the gap between lucidity and insanity. He wanted an analysis of every case even remotely involving the signing of a will by a person considered crazy.
The second team was dispatched to research holographic wills, specifically the best ways to attack and defend them. When he was alone with the third team, he relaxed and sat down. They were the lucky ones because they would not spend the next 3 days in the library.
"You have to find a person who, I suspect, does not want to be found."
He told them what he knew about Rachel Lane. There wasn't much. The file from Troy's desk provided little information.
"First, research World Tribes missions. Who are they? How do they operate? How do they pick their people? Where do they send them? Everything. Second, there are some excellent private locators in D.C. They're usually ex-FBI and government types who specialize in finding missing people. Select the top two and we'll make a decision tomorrow. Third, Rachel's mother's name was Evelyn Cunningham, now deceased. Let's put together a bio on her. We're assuming she and Mr. Phelan had a fling that produced a child."
"Assuming?" asked one of the associates.
"Yes. We take nothing for granted."
He dismissed them and walked to a room where a small press conference had been arranged by Tip Durbin. No cameras, just print media. A dozen reporters sat eagerly around a table, tape recorders and microphones scattered about. They were from large newspapers and well-known financial publications. The questions began. Yes, there was a last-minute will, but he could not reveal its contents. Yes, there'd been an autopsy, but he couldn't discuss it. The company would continue operating with no changes. He couldn't talk about who the new owners would be. To no one's surprise, it became obvious that the families had spent the day chatting privately with reporters. "There's a strong rumor that Mr. Phelan's last will divides his fortune among his 6 children. Can you confirm or deny this?"
"I cannot. It's just a rumor."
"Wasn't he dying of cancer?"
"That would go to the autopsy, and I can't comment on that."
"We've heard that a panel of psychiatrists examined him shortly before his death and pronounced him mentally sound. Can you confirm this?"
"Yes," Stafford said. "This is true."
So they spent the next 20 minutes picking and prying into the mental exam. Josh held his ground, allowing only that Mr. Phelan appeared to be of sound mind. The financial reporters wanted numbers. Because the Phelan Group was a private company, very tightly held, information had always been hard to come by. This was an opportunity to crack the door, or so they thought. But Josh gave them little. He excused himself after an hour and returned to his office, where a secretary informed him that the crematorium had called. Mr. Phelan's remains were ready to be picked up. Chapter 5 T.J. nursed his hangover until noon, then drank a beer and decided it was time to flex his muscle. He called his principal lawyer to check on the current state of things, and the lawyer cautioned him to be patient. "This will take a little time, T.J.," the lawyer said.
"Maybe I'm not in the mood to wait," T.J. shot back, his head splitting.
"Give it a few days." T.J. slammed the phone down and walked to the rear of his dirty condo, where, thankfully, he couldn't find his wife. They had been through 3 fights already, and it was barely noon. Perhaps she was out shopping, spending a fraction of his new fortune. The shopping didn't bother him now.
"The old goat's dead," he said out loud. There was no one else around.
His 2 children were away at college, their tuition paid for by Lillian, who still had some of the money she'd taken from Troy in the divorce decades earlier. So T.J. lived alone with Biff, a 30-year-old divorcee whose 2 kids lived with their father. Biff had a real estate license and sold darling little starters to newlyweds. He opened another beer and stared at himself in a full-length mirror in the hall.
"Troy Phelan, Jr.," he proclaimed. "Son of Troy Phelan, 10th richest man in America. Net worth of $11 billion, now deceased. Survived by his loving wives and loving children, all of whom will love him even more after probate. Yes."
He decided right then and there that from that day forward, T.J. would be ditched and he would go through life as Troy Phelan, Jr. The name was magic. The condo had a certain smell to it because Biff refused to do housework. She was too busy with her cell phones. The floors were covered with debris, but the walls were bare. The furniture was rented from a company that had hired lawyers to recover everything. He kicked a sofa and yelled, "Come get this crap! I'll be hiring designers before long!" He could almost torch the place. Another beer or two and he might start playing with matches. He dressed in his best suit, a gray one he'd worn yesterday when dear old Dad faced the psychiatrist and performed so wonderfully. Since there would be no funeral, he wouldn't be forced to rush out and buy a new black one. "Armani, here I come," he whistled joyfully as he zipped up his pants. At least he had a BMW. He might live in a dump, but the world would never see it. The world, however, noticed his car, and so he struggled every month to scratch together $680 for the lease. He cursed his condo as he backed away in the parking lot. It was one of 80 new ones wrapped around a shallow pool in an overflow section of Manassas. He'd been raised better. Life had been soft and luxurious for the first 20 years, and then he received his inheritance. But his $5 million had disappeared before he reached 30, and his father despised him for it. They fought with vigor and regularity. Junior had held various jobs within the Phelan Group, and each ended in disaster. Senior fired him numerous times. Senior had an idea for a venture, and 2 years later the idea was worth millions. Junior's ideas ended in bankruptcy and litigation. In recent years, the fighting had almost stopped. Neither could change, so they simply ignored each other. But when the tumor appeared, TJ reached out again. Oh, what a mansion he would build. And he knew just the architect, a Japanese woman in Manhattan he'd read about in a magazine. Within a year, he'd probably move to Malibu or Aspen or Palm Beach, where he could show the money and be taken seriously. "What does one do with $500 million? He asked himself as he sped along the interstate. $500 million tax-free dollars. He began to laugh. An acquaintance managed the BMW Porsche dealership where he'd leased his car. Junior walked into the showroom like the king of the world, strutting and smiling smugly. He could buy the whole damn place if he wanted. On a salesman's desk, he saw the morning paper, a nice, bold headline about the death of his father, not a twinge of grief. The manager, Dickie, bounded from his office and said, "TJ, I'm very sorry." "Thanks," Troy Jr. said with a brief frown. "He's better off, you know." "My sympathies, anyway." "Forget it." They stepped into the office and closed the door. Dickie said, "The paper says he signed a will just before he died. Is that true?" Troy Jr. was already looking at the slick brochures for the latest models. "Yes, I was there. He divided his estate into 6 pieces, one for each of us." He said this without looking up, quite casually, as if the money were already in hand and already becoming a burden. Dickie's mouth slipped open, and he lowered himself into his chair. Was he suddenly in the presence of serious wealth? This guy, the worthless T.J. Phelan, now a billionaire? Like everyone else who knew T.J., Dickie assumed the old man had cut him off for good. "Biff would like a Porsche," Troy Jr. said, still studying the charts. "A red 911 Carrera turbo with both tops." "When?" Troy Jr. glared at him. "Now." "Sure, TJ. What about payment?" "I'll pay for it the same time I pay for my black one, also a 911. How much are they?" "About $90,000 each." "No problem. When can we take delivery?" "I'll have to find them first. That should take a day or two. Cash?" "Of course." "When will you get the cash?" "A month or so, but I want the cars now." Dickie caught his breath and did a squirm. "Look, TJ, I can't turn loose 2 new cars without some type of payment." "Fine. Then we'll look at Jaguars. Biff's always wanted a Jaguar." "Come on, TJ. I could buy this entire dealership, you know. I could walk in any bank right now and ask for $10 million or $20 million or whatever it would take to buy this place, and they would happily give it to me for 60 days. Do you understand that?
Dickie's head rocked up and down, his eyes narrow. Yes, he understood.
How much did he leave you?
Enough to buy the bank, too.
Are you giving me the cars, or shall I go down the street?
Let me find him.
Smart man, TJ said. Hurry, I'll check back this afternoon. Get on the phone.
He tossed the brochures on Dickie's desk and strutted from the office. Ramble's idea of morning was to spend the day locked in the basement den, smoking pot, listening to rap, ignoring those who knocked or called. His mother granted him an absence from school because of the tragedy. In fact, she excused him for the rest of the week. If she'd had a clue, she would have known he hadn't been to school in a month. Driving away from Phelan Tower yesterday, his lawyer had told him the money would go into a trust until he was either 18 or 21, depending on the terms of the will. And though he couldn't touch the money now, he was certainly entitled to a generous allowance. He would form a band, and with his money they would make albums. He had friends in bands going nowhere because they couldn't afford to rent studio time, but his would be different. His band would be called Ramble, he decided, and he would play bass and sing lead and be chased by the girls. Alternative rock with strong rap influences, something new, something he was already inventing. Two floors up, in the study of their spacious home, Tyra, his mother, spent the day on the phone, chatting with friends who called with their half-hearted condolences. Most of the friends gossiped long enough to ask how much she might be getting from the estate, but she was afraid to guess. She had married Troy in 1982 at the age of 23, and before doing so she signed a thick prenuptial which gave her only $10 million and a house in the event of a divorce. They had split 6 years earlier. She was down to her last $2 million. Her needs were so great. Her friends had beach houses nestled in quiet coves in the Bahamas. She was relegated to luxury hotels. They bought their designer clothes in New York. She picked them up locally. Their children were away in boarding schools, out of the way. Ramble was in the basement and wouldn't come out. Surely Troy had left her $50 million or so. 1% of his estate would be around $100 million. 1 lousy percent. She did the math on a paper napkin as she talked on the phone to her lawyer. Gina Phelan Strong was 30 and surviving what had evolved into a tumultuous marriage with Cody, husband number 2. His family was old money from up east, but so far the money had been only a rumor. She certainly hadn't seen any of it. Cody was beautifully educated, Taft and Dartmouth and an MBA from Columbia, and he considered himself a visionary in the world of commerce. No job could hold him. His talents could not be constricted by the walls of an office. His dreams would not be cramped by the orders and whims of bosses. Cody would be a billionaire, self-made, of course, and probably the youngest in history. But after 6 years together, Cody had yet to find his niche. In fact, his losses were staggering. There had been a bad gamble on copper futures in 1992 that had taken over $1 million of Gina's money. And 2 years later, he was scalded by naked options when the stock market dipped dramatically. Gina left him for 4 months but returned after counseling. An idea for snow-packed chickens turned sour, and Cody escaped with a loss of only $500,000. They spent a lot. Their counselor recommended traveling as a means of therapy, so they'd seen the world. Being young and rich soothed many of their problems, but the money was drying up. The $5 million Troy gave her on her 21st birthday had shrunk to less than $1 million, and their debts were mounting. The pressure on their marriage had reached the breaking point when Troy leaped from his terrace. And so they spent a busy morning looking for homes in Swink's Mill, the place of their grandest dreams. Their dreams grew as the day progressed, and by lunch they were making inquiries into homes worth over $2 million.
At 2, they met an anxious real estate agent, a woman named Lee, with teased hair, gold rings, 2 cell phones, and a shiny Cadillac. Gina introduced herself as Gina Phelan, with the last name pronounced heavy and uncheated. Evidently, Lee did not read financial publications because the name missed its mark, and well into the third showing, Cody was forced to pull her aside and whisper the truth about his father-in-law.
"That rich guy who jumped?" Lee said, hand over mouth.
Gina was inspecting a hallway closet with a small sauna tucked into it. Cody nodded sadly. By dusk, they were looking at an empty home priced at $4.5 million, and the prospective buyers were seriously considering making an offer. Lee rarely saw such wealthy clients, and they'd worked her into a frenzy. Rex, age 44, brother to TJ, was, at the time of Troy's death, the only one of his children under criminal investigation. His trouble stemmed from a bank that failed, with various lawsuits and investigations spinning wildly from it. Bank examiners and the FBI had been making rather fierce inquiries for 3 years. To fund his defense and his expensive lifestyle, Rex had purchased from the estate of a man killed in a gunfight a string of topless bars and strip clubs in the Fort Lauderdale area. The skin business was lucrative, traffic was always good, and cash was easy to skim. Without being overly greedy, he pocketed around $24,000 a month in tax-free dollars, roughly $4,000 from each of his 6 clubs. The clubs were held in the name of Amber Rockwell, his wife and a former stripper he'd first noticed lurching on a bar one night. In fact, all of his assets were in her name, and this caused him no small amount of anxiety. With the addition of clothing and minus the makeup and kinky shoes, Amber passed herself off as respectable in their Washington circles. Few people knew her past. But she was a whore at heart, and the fact that she owned everything caused poor Rex many sleepless nights. At the time of his father's death, Rex had lodged against him in excess of $7 million worth of liens and judgments from creditors, business partners, and investors in the bank. And the total was growing. The judgments, though, remained unsatisfied because there was nothing for the creditors to attach. Rex was asset-free. He owned nothing, not even his car. He and Amber leased a condo and matching Corvettes with all the paperwork in her name. The clubs and bars were owned by an offshore corporation organized by her without a trace of him. Rex so far had proved too slippery to catch. The marriage was as stable as could be expected from two people with histories of instability. They partied a lot and had wild friends, clingers drawn to the Phelan name. Life was fun, in spite of the financial pressures. But Rex worried fanatically about Amber and her assets. A nasty argument, and she could vanish. The worrying stopped with Troy's death. The seesaw tilted, and suddenly Rex was on top, his last name finally worth a fortune. He'd sell the bars and clubs, pay off his debts with a wicked swipe, then play with his money. One false move, and she'd be dancing on tables again with wet dollar bills stuck in her G-string. Rex spent the day with Hart Geddes, his lawyer. He wanted the money quickly, desperately, and he pressured Geddes to call Josh Stafford and ask for a look at the will. Rex made plans, large and ambitious plans for how to handle the money, and Hart would be with him every step of the way. He wanted control of the Phelan Group. His portion of the stock, whatever it might be, added to TJ's and both sisters, would surely give them a majority of voting shares. But was the stock placed in trust, or given outright, or tied up in any one of 100 devious ways that Troy would certainly enjoy from the grave? "We have to see that damned will," he yelled at Hart throughout the day. Hart calmed him with a long lunch and good wine, then they switched to scotch in the early afternoon. Amber dropped by and found them both drunk, but she wasn't angry. There was no way Rex could anger her now. She loved him more than ever.
Chapter 6 The trip west would be a pleasant respite from the chaos Mr. Phelan created with his leap. His ranch was near Jackson Hole in the Tetons, where a foot of snow was already on the ground, and more was expected. What would Miss Manners say about the scattering of ashes over land covered with snow? Should one wait until the thaw, or sprinkle them anyway? Josh didn't give a damn. He tossed them in the face of any natural disaster. He was being hounded by the lawyers for the Phelan heirs. His cautious comments to Hart Geddes about the old man's testamentary capacity had sent shockwaves through the families, and they were reacting with predictable hysteria. And threats. The trip would be a short vacation. He and Durbin could sort through the preliminary research and make their plans. They left National Airport on Mr. Phelan's Gulfstream IV, a plane Josh had been privileged to fly on only once before. It was the newest of the fleet, and at a price of $35 million had been Mr. Phelan's fanciest toy. The summer before, they had flown it to Nice, where the old man walked naked on the beach and gawked at young French girls. Josh and his wife had kept their clothes on, with the rest of the Americans, and sunned by the pool. A stewardess served them breakfast, then disappeared into the rear galley as they spread their papers on a round table. The flight would take 4 hours. The affidavits signed by Doctors Flo, Zadel, and Thetian were long and verbose, laden with opinions and redundancies that ran on for paragraphs and left not a scintilla of doubt that Troy was of sound and disposing mind and memory. He was downright brilliant, and knew exactly what he was doing in the moments before his death. Stafford and Durbin read the affidavits and enjoyed the humor. When the new will was read, those three experts would be fired, of course, and half a dozen more would be brought in to deliver all sorts of dark and dire suppositions about poor Troy's mental illnesses. On the subject of Rachel Lane, little had been learned about the world's richest missionary. The investigators hired by the firm were digging furiously. According to the early research pulled from the Internet, World Tribes Missions was headquartered in Houston, Texas. Founded in 1920, the organization had 4,000 missionaries spread around the world, working exclusively with native peoples. Its sole purpose and goal was to spread the Christian gospel to every remote tribe in the world. Obviously, Rachel did not inherit her religious beliefs from her father. No less than 28 Indian tribes in Brazil were currently being ministered to by World Tribes missionaries, and at least 10 in Bolivia. Another 300 in the rest of the world. Because their target tribes were secluded and detached from modern civilization, the missionaries received exhaustive training in survival, wilderness living, languages, and medical skills. Josh read with great interest a story written by a missionary who spent 7 years living in a lean-to in a jungle trying to learn enough of the primitive tribe's language to communicate. The Indians had had little to do with him. He was, after all, a white man from Missouri who'd backpacked into their village with a vocabulary limited to hello and thank you. If he needed a table, he built one. If he needed food, he killed it. 5 years passed before the Indians began to trust him. He was well into his 6th year before he told his first Bible story. He was trained to be patient, to build relationships, learn language and culture, and slowly, very slowly, begin to teach the Bible. The tribe had little contact with the outside world. Life had hardly changed in 1,000 years. What kind of person could possess enough faith and commitment to forsake modern society and enter such a prehistoric world? The missionary wrote that the Indians did not accept him until they realized he wasn't leaving. He had chosen to live with them forever. He loved them and wanted to be one of them. So,
Rachel lived in a hut or a lean-to and slept on a bed she'd built herself and cooked over a fire and ate food she'd grown or trapped and killed and taught Bible stories to the children and the gospel to the adults and knew nothing and certainly cared nothing for the events and worries and pressures of the world. She was very content. Her faith sustained her. It seemed almost cruel to bother her. Durbin read the same materials and said, "We may never find her. No phones, no electricity. Hell, you have to hike through the mountains to get to these people." "We have no choice," Josh said. "Have we contacted World Tribes?" "Later today." "What do you tell them?" "I don't know." "But you don't tell them you're looking for one of their missionaries because she's just inherited $11 billion. $11 billion before taxes. There will be a nice sum left over." "So what do you tell them?" "We tell them there's a pressing legal matter. It's quite urgent, and we must speak to Rachel face to face." One of the fax machines on board began humming, and the memo started. The first was from Josh's secretary with a list of the morning's calls, almost all from attorneys for the Phelan heirs. Two were from reporters. The associates were reporting in, with preliminary research on various aspects of applicable Virginia law. With each page that Josh and Durbin read, old Troy's hastily scrawled testament got stronger and stronger. Lunch was light sandwiches and fruit, again served by the stewardess, who kept to the rear of the cabin and managed to appear only when their coffee cups were empty. They landed in Jackson Hole in clear weather with heavy snow plowed to the sides of the runway. They stepped off the plane, walked 80 feet, and climbed onto a Sikorsky S-76C-160, Troy's favorite helicopter. 10 minutes later, they were hovering over his beloved ranch. A stiff wind bounced the chopper, and Durbin turned pale. Josh slid open a door, slowly and quite nervously, and a sharp wind blasted him in the face. The pilot circled at 2,000 feet while Josh emptied the ashes from a small black urn. The wind instantly blew them in all directions so that Troy's remains vanished long before they hit the snow. When the urn was empty, Josh retracted his frozen arm and hand and shut the door. The house was technically a log cabin with enough massive timbers to give the appearance of something rustic. But at 11,000 square feet, it was anything but a cabin. Troy had bought it from an actor whose career went south. A butler in corduroy took their bags and a maid fixed their coffee. Durbin admired the stuffed game hanging from the walls while Josh called the office. A fire roared in the fireplace, and the cook asked what they wanted for dinner. The associate's name was Montgomery, a 4-year man who'd been handpicked by Mr. Stafford. He got lost 3 times in the sprawl of Houston before he found the offices of World Tribes Missions tucked away on the ground floor of a 5-story building. He parked his rented car and straightened his tie. He had talked to Mr. Trill 2 times on the phone, and though he was an hour late for the appointment, it didn't seem to matter. Mr. Trill was polite and soft-spoken, but not eager to help. They exchanged the required preliminaries. "Now, what can I do for you?" Trill asked. "I need some information about one of your missionaries," Montgomery said. Trill nodded but said nothing. "Rachel Lane." The eyes drifted as if he was trying to place her. "Name doesn't ring a bell, but then we have 4,000 people in the field. She's working near the border of Brazil and Bolivia." "How much do you know about her?"
"Not much, but we need to find her."
"For what purpose?"
"It's a legal matter," Montgomery said, with just enough hesitation to sound suspicious.
Trill frowned and pulled his elbows close to his chest. His small smile disappeared.
"Is there trouble?" he asked.
"No. But the matter is quite urgent. We need to see her."
Can't you send a letter or a package?
Afraid not. Her cooperation is needed along with her signature.
I assume it's confidential.
Extremely.
Something clicked, and Trill's frown softened.
Excuse me for a minute.
He disappeared from the office and left Montgomery to inspect the Spartan furnishings. The only decoration was a collection of enlarged photos of Indian children on the walls. Trill was a different person when he returned, stiff and unsmiling and uncooperative.
"I'm sorry, Mr. Montgomery," he said without sitting. "We will not be able to help you."
"Is she in Brazil?"
"I'm sorry."
"Bolivia?"
"I'm sorry."
"Does she even exist?"
"I can't answer your questions."
"Nothing?"
"Nothing."
"Could I speak to your boss or supervisor?"
"Sure."
"Where is he?"
"In heaven."
After a dinner of thick steaks and mushroom sauce, Josh Stafford and Tip Durbin retired to the den, where a fire roared. A different butler, a Mexican in a white jacket and starched jeans, served them very old single malt scotch from Mr. Phelan's cabinet. Cuban cigars were ordered. Pavarotti sang Christmas songs on a distant stereo.
"I have an idea," Josh said as he watched the fire. "We have to send someone to find Rachel Lane, right?"
Tip was in the midst of a lengthy draw from his cigar, so he only nodded.
"And we can't just send anyone. It has to be a lawyer, someone who can explain the legal issues. And it has to be someone from our firm because of confidentiality."
His jaws filled with smoke, Tip kept nodding.
"So, who do we send?"
Tip exhaled slowly through both his mouth and his nose, and smoke boiled across his face and drifted upward.
"How long will it take?" he finally asked.
"I don't know, but it's not a quick trip. Brazil's a big country, almost as big as the lower 48. And we're talking jungles and mountains. These people are so remote they've never seen a car."
"I'm not going."
"We can hire local guides and such, but it still might take a week or so."
"Don't they have cannibals down there?"
"No."
"Anacondas?"
"Relax, Tip. You're not going."
"Thanks."
"But you see the problem, don't you? We have 60 lawyers, all busy as hell and swamped with more work than we can possibly do. None of us can suddenly drop everything and go find this woman."
"Send a paralegal."
Josh didn't like that idea. He sipped his scotch and puffed his cigar and listened to the flames pop in the fireplace.
"It has to be a lawyer," he said, almost to himself.
The butler returned with fresh drinks. He inquired about dessert and coffee, but the guests already had what they wanted.
"What about Nate?"
Josh asked when they were alone again. It was obvious Josh had been thinking about Nate all along, and this slightly irritated Tip.
"You kidding?" he said.
"No."
For a while, they pondered the idea of sending Nate, each working past their initial objections and fears. Nate O'Reilly was a partner, a 23-year man who was at the moment locked away in a rehab unit in the Blue Ridge Mountains west of D.C. In the past 10 years, he had been a frequent visitor to rehab facilities, each time drying out, breaking habits, growing closer to a higher power, working on his tan and tennis game, and vowing to kick his addictions once and for all. And while he swore that each crash was the last one, the final descent to rock bottom, each was always followed by an even harder fall. Now, at the age of 48, he was broke, twice divorced, and freshly indicted for income tax evasion. His future was anything but bright.
"He used to be an outdoor type, didn't he?"
Tip asked.
"Oh, yeah. Scuba diving, rock climbing, all that crazy stuff. Then the slide began and he did nothing but work."
The slide had begun in his mid-30s, at about the time he put together an impressive string of large verdicts against negligent doctors. Nate O'Reilly became a star in the medical malpractice game, and also began drinking heavily and using coke. He neglected his family and became obsessive about his addictions, big verdicts, booze, and drugs. He somehow balanced both, but was always on the edge of disaster. Then he lost a case and fell off the cliff for the first time. The firm hid him in a designer spa until he was sufficiently dried out, and he made an impressive comeback, the first of several. "When does he get out?" Tip asked, no longer surprised by the idea and liking it more and more. "Soon." But Nate had become a serious addict. He could stay clean for months, even years, but he always crashed. The chemicals ravaged his mind and body. His behavior became quite bizarre, and the rumors of his craziness crept through the firm and ultimately spread through the lawyer's network of gossip. Almost 4 months earlier, he had locked himself in a motel room with a bottle of rum and a sack of pills in what many of his colleagues viewed as a suicide attempt. Josh had committed him for the fourth time in 10 years.
"It might be good for him," Tip said. "You know, to get away for a while."
Chapter 7. On the third day after Mr. Phelan's suicide, Hark Geddes arrived at his office before dawn, already tired but anxious for the day to begin. He'd had a late dinner with Rex Phelan, followed by a couple of hours in a bar where they fretted over the will and plotted strategy. So his eyes were red and puffy and his head ached, but he was nonetheless moving quickly around the coffee pot. Hark's hourly rates varied. In the past year, he'd handled a nasty divorce for as little as $200 an hour. He quoted $350 to every prospective client, which was a bit low for such an ambitious D.C. lawyer, but if he got them in the door at $350, he could certainly pad the billing and earn what he deserved. An Indonesian cement company had paid him $450 an hour for a small matter, then tried to stiff him when the bill came. He had settled a wrongful death case in which he earned a third of $350,000, so he was all over the board when it came to fees. Hark was a litigator in a 40-lawyer firm, a second-tier outfit with a history of infighting and bickering which had hampered its growth, and he longed to open his own shop. Almost half of his annual billings went for the overhead. The way he figured it, the money belonged in his pocket. At some point during this sleepless night, he'd made the decision to raise his rate to $500 an hour, and to make it retroactive a week. He'd worked on nothing but the Phelan matter for the past 6 days, and now that the old man was dead, his crazy family was a lawyer's dream. What Hark desperately wanted was a will contest, a long, vicious fight with packs of lawyers filing tons of legal crap. A trial would be wonderful, a high-profile battle over one of the largest estates in America, with Hark in the center. Winning it would be nice, but winning wasn't crucial. He'd make a fortune, and he'd become famous, and that's what modern lawyering was all about. At $500 an hour, 60 hours a week, 50 weeks a year, Hark's gross annual billings would be $1.5 million. The overhead for a new office, rent, secretaries, paralegals, would be $500,000 at most, and so Hark could clear $1 million if he left his miserable firm and opened a new one down the street. Done. He gulped coffee and mentally said goodbye to his cluttered office. He'd bolt with the Phelan file and maybe one or two others. He'd take his secretary and his paralegal, and he'd do it quickly, before the firm laid claim to any of the Phelan fees. He sat at his desk, his pulse racing with the anticipation of his spanking new venture, and he thought of all the ways he could start a war with Josh Stafford. There was reason to worry. Stafford had been unwilling to reveal the contents of the new will. He had questioned its validity in light of the suicide. Hark had been rattled by the change in Stafford's tone immediately after the suicide. Now, Stafford had left town,
and refused to return calls. Oh, how he longed for a fight. At 9, he met with Libigail Phelan Jeter and Mary Ross Phelan Jackman, the two daughters from Troy's first marriage. Rex had arranged the meeting at Hark's insistence. Though both women had lawyers at the moment, Hark wanted them as clients. More clients meant more clout at the bargaining table and in the courtroom, and it also meant he could bill each one of them $500 an hour for the same work. The meeting was awkward. Neither woman trusted Hark because they didn't trust their brother, Rex. TJ had three lawyers of his own, and their mother had another. Why should they join forces when no one else was doing so? With so much money at stake, shouldn't they keep their own lawyers? Hark pressed, but gained little ground. He was disappointed, but later charged ahead with plans to leave his firm immediately. He could smell the money. Libigail Phelan Jeter had been a rebellious child who disliked Lillian, her mother, and craved the attention of her father, who was seldom at home. She was 9 when her parents divorced. When she was 14, Lillian shipped her away to boarding school. Troy disapproved of boarding schools as if he knew something about child-rearing, and throughout high school he made an uncharacteristic effort to keep in touch with her. He often told her she was his favorite. She was certainly the brightest. But he missed her graduation and forgot to send a gift. In the summer before college, she dreamed of ways to hurt him. She fled to Berkeley, ostensibly to study medieval Irish poetry, but in fact she planned to study very little, if at all. Troy hated the idea of her attending college anywhere in California, especially on such a radical campus. Vietnam was ending, the students had won, and it was time to celebrate. She slipped easily into the culture of drugs and casual sex. She lived in a 3-story house with a group of students of all races, sexes, and sexual preferences. The combinations changed weekly, as did the numbers. They called themselves a commune, but there was no structure or rules. Money was no problem, because most came from wealthy families. Libigail was known simply as a rich kid from Connecticut. At the time, Troy was worth only $100 million or so. With a sense of adventure, she moved along the drug chain until heroin seized her. Her supplier was a jazz drummer named Tino, who had somehow taken up residence in the commune. Tino was in his late 30s, a high school dropout from Memphis, and no one knew exactly how or when he became a member of their group. No one cared. Libigail cleaned herself up enough to travel east for her 21st birthday, a glorious day for all Phelan children, because that was when the old man bestowed the gift. Troy didn't believe in trusts for his children. If they weren't stable by the age of 21, then why string them along? Trusts required trustees and lawyers and constant fights with the beneficiaries who resented having their money doled out by accountants. Give them the money, Troy reasoned. Let him sink or swim. Most Phelans drowned quickly. Troy skipped her birthday. He was somewhere in Asia on business. By then he was well into his second marriage with Janie. Rocky and Gina were little kids, and he'd lost whatever interest he had in his first family. Libigail didn't miss him. The lawyers completed the arrangements for the gift, and she laid up with Tino in a swanky Manhattan hotel for a week, stoned. Her money lasted for almost 5 years, a stretch of time that included 2 husbands, numerous live-ins, 2 arrests, 3 lengthy lockdowns in detox units, and a car wreck that almost took her left leg. Her current husband was an ex-biker she'd met in rehab. He weighed 320 pounds and had a gray, frizzy beard that fell to his chest. He went by the name of Spike, and he had actually evolved into a decent sort. He built cabinets in a shop behind their modest home in the Baltimore suburb of Lutherville. Libigail's lawyer was a rumpled fellow named Wally Bright, and she went straight to his office after leaving Hark's. She made a full report of everything Hark had said. Wally was a small-timer who advertised quickie divorces on bus benches in the Bethesda area. He'd handled one of Libigale's divorces and waited a year before he was paid for it. But he'd been patient with her. She was, after all, a Phelan. She would be his ticket to the fat fees he'd never quite been able to command. In her presence, Wally called Hark Geddes and started a vicious phone fight that raged for 15 minutes. He stomped around behind his desk, arms flailing, screaming obscenities into the phone. "I will kill for my client," he raged at one point. And Libigale was most impressed. When he finished, he walked her gently to the door and kissed her on the cheek. He stroked her and patted her and fussed over her. He gave her the attention she had craved all her life. She was not a bad-looking woman, a bit heavy and showing the effects of a hard life, but Wally had seen much worse. Wally had slept with much worse. Given the right moment, Wally might make a move. Chapter 8 Nate's little mountain was covered with 6 inches of new snow when he was awakened by the stirring sounds of Chopin piped through his walls. Last week it had been Mozart. The week before he couldn't remember. Vivaldi had been in his recent past, but so much of it was a haze. As he had done every morning for almost 4 months, Nate walked to his window and gazed at the Shenandoah Valley spread before him, 3,000 feet below. It, too, was covered with white, and he remembered that it was almost Christmas. He would be out in time for Christmas. They, his doctors and Josh Stafford, had promised him that much. He thought about Christmas and became saddened by it. There had been some pleasant ones in the not-too-distant past, when the kids were small and life was stable. But the kids were gone now, either grown or taken away by their mothers, and the last thing Nate wanted was another Christmas in a bar with other miserable drunks, singing carols and pretending all was merry. The valley was white and still, a few cars moving like ants far away. He was supposed to meditate for 10 minutes, either in prayer or with the yoga they'd tried to teach him at Walnut Hill. Instead, he did sit-ups, then went for a swim. Breakfast was black coffee and a muffin, which he took with Sergio, his counselor, therapist, guru. And for the past 4 months, Sergio had also been his best friend. He knew everything about the miserable life of Nate O'Reilly. "You have a guest today," Sergio said.
"Who?"
"Mr. Stafford."
"Wonderful."
Any contact with the outside was welcome, primarily because it was so restricted. Josh had visited once a month. 2 other friends from the firm had made the 3-hour drive from D.C., but they were busy, and Nate understood. Television was prohibited at Walnut Hill because of the beer ads and because so many of the shows and movies glorified drinking, even drugs. Most popular magazines were kept away for the same reasons. It didn't matter to Nate. After 4 months, he didn't care what was happening at the Capitol or on Wall Street or in the Middle East.
"When?" he asked.
"Late morning."
"After my workout?"
"Of course." Nothing interfered with the workout. A 2-hour orgy of sweat and grunting and yelling with a sadistic personal trainer, a sharply toned female Nate secretly adored. He was resting in his suite, eating a blood orange and watching the valley again, when Josh arrived.
"You look great," Josh said. "How much weight have you lost?"
14 pounds, Nate said, patting his flat stomach.
"Very lean. Maybe I should spend some time here."
"I highly recommend it. The food is completely fat-free, taste-free, prepared by a chef with an accent. The portions cover 1/2 saucer, a couple of bites, and you're done. Lunch and dinner take about 7 minutes if you chew slowly."
"For $1,000 a day, you expect great food."
Did you bring me some cookies or something, Josh? Some Chips Ahoy or Oreos? Surely you hid something in your briefcase.
Sorry, Nate, I'm clean.
Some Doritos or M&Ms?
Sorry.
Nate took a bite of his orange. They were sitting next to each other, enjoying the view. Minutes passed.
How are you doing? Josh asked.
I need to get out of here, Josh. I'm becoming a robot.
Your doc says another week or so.
Great, then what?
We'll see.
What does that mean?
It means we'll see.
Come on, Josh.
We'll take our time and see what happens.
Can I come back to the firm, Josh? Talk to me.
Not so fast, Nate. You have enemies.
Who doesn't? But hell, it's your firm. Those guys will go along with whatever you say.
You have a couple of problems.
I have 1,000 problems, but you can't kick me out.
The bankruptcy we can work through. The indictment is not so easy.
No, it was not so easy, and Nate couldn't simply dismiss it. From 1992 to 1995, he had failed to report about $60,000 in other income.
He tossed the orange peel in a wastebasket and said, "So what am I supposed to do, sit around the house all day?"
"If you're lucky."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
Josh had to be delicate. His friend was emerging from a black hole. Shocks and surprises had to be avoided.
"Do you think I'm going to prison?"
Nate asked.
"Troy Phelan died," Josh said,
and it took Nate a second to change course.
"Oh, Mr. Phelan," he said.
Nate had had his own little wing in the firm. It was at the end of a long hallway on the 6th floor, and he and another lawyer and 3 paralegals and a half dozen secretaries worked on suing doctors and cared little about the rest of the firm. He certainly knew who Troy Phelan was, but he'd never touched his legal work.
"I'm sorry," he said.
"So you haven't heard?"
"I hear nothing here. When did he die?"
4 days ago. Jumped from a window.
Without a parachute?
Bingo.
Couldn't fly?
No. He didn't try. I saw it happen. He had just signed 2 wills, the first prepared by me, the second and last handwritten by himself. Then he bolted and jumped.
You saw it?